221588, United States of America versus Dale Thrush. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. A.R. for appellant.
Morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
The main thing I'd like to point out, without getting repetitive from what's already been fully briefed, is the reason we're here today is because the government chose to withhold important information from the trial court before the trial started. And then after the trial started, they tried to cover it up and got caught.
What are you talking about?
Well, but for the fact that they withheld the information about the COVID test concerning their witness, Donna Henke, there would not have been a mistrial. And but for the fact that...
Well, how can you say that? Because the judge claimed that there was a confluence of reasons, that and at least a couple of other reasons, and that he granted the mistrial.
Well, the judge did cite a confluence of factors. However, I believe it's clear from the record that the primary factor was the unavailability of the government's witness, Donna Henke. The other two factors that the judge mentioned were the unavailability of one of the witnesses, of one of the jurors, for which there were sufficient alternates. And the other reason that the judge cited was due to the fact that his wife had COVID and he himself was not available to enter the courtroom. However, he stated on the record that he could have had another person preside over the trial in his place, but didn't seem that would be sufficient. So,
or he could have awaited the result of a COVID test on himself, which he had not obtained. So we don't know if the trial judge would have been unavailable or not, right?
We don't know if Judge Ludington would have been unavailable or not, and we also don't know if there were any other replacement judges available to come take his seat, unfortunately, because those options were not explored at the trial court level.
Okay.
And it is well settled case law that before declaring a mistrial, the judge is supposed to consider less drastic alternatives. And in this case, he did not consider any alternatives that did not include Ms. Henke testifying. There were other ways that the trial could have continued, namely by either finding another judge or awaiting for the court's COVID test results.
I thought the jurors had problems too.
One juror had a sick child, but as the court's aware, in every trial there are alternate jurors, and there
didn't he try to move it a few weeks, and then the jurors said they couldn't do it for conflict?
He tried to move it a few weeks, but he did not try to move it for a shorter period of time. And the reason that they wanted to move it a few weeks was to give Ms. Henke time to recover from her COVID. An alternate to moving it all the way from the beginning of November to the end of November would have been to offer a short continuance of a day or two while the court tried to figure out alternate ways to continue the trial.
The other problem is with the jurors, it wasn't even clear that the alleged conflicts were actual conflicts worthy of being considered. I mean, one person wanted to go to a wedding, the other one didn't want to miss some kid's ball game or something. I mean, these are the kinds of things that happen for normal jury service that people give up to normally to serve on jurors. I mean, none of this, most of the jurors who were offering excuses, most of those excuses were not at all compelling, wouldn't you think? And then these were conflicts at a point in time to which the judge was contemplating adjourning the trial, but he could have adjourned the trial to a lesser time interval or a greater time interval to avoid those conflicts. He didn't even talk about doing that. So what we've got here is a judge saying he was around somebody who had COVID. We don't know if he had it because he didn't await a test. Jurors being unavailable, which doesn't really sound like most of them were unavailable. And then there's the matter of Hinkie's testimony, and he didn't even seriously consider having her testify remotely. So, you know, I guess I'm kind of preliminarily at least buying your argument to some extent.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I agree, obviously, with everything that you said. And I think that the way that this all transpired and how fast it all happened, it appears that this was not carefully considered, especially considering that walking into court that day, the judge did not know that the prosecution knew that Ms. Hinkie had COVID prior to the start of the trial.
They had a rapid test, right, that revealed it, and they were waiting to get back a real test. The rapid test is often wrong, and she was vaccinated and not showing symptoms.
That is true that she was vaccinated and not showing symptoms. I think the science on the rapid test often being wrong, the issue is that sometimes it provides false negatives. I think that the scientific community had a consensus that false positives are very, very rare, even with rapid tests. The only time that a false positive ever happens is when they make
no symptoms and was vaccinated. So it seemed like it could be a time where there's a false positive.
It seemed like it could be a time with a false positive, but it's not even clear that the subsequent negative test would have allowed her to enter the courtroom because
the government didn't ask for a mistrial. They proposed all sorts of alternatives.
I think they didn't ask for a mistrial because they knew that they knew she had COVID and they shouldn't get a mistrial in those circumstances.
The problem, though, was at least one of the many problems here is that during the proceedings, after the discussion and back and forth between the judge and counsel, the government ended up agreeing with the judge that he should declare a mistrial. And why they did that, I'm completely baffled. But the government agreed that a mistrial would be a fine thing in the end.
That they did. And when they were briefing the issue and they alerted the court of Ms. Hinkie's COVID test, they never mentioned that of the positive rapid test. And that fact would have never came up. But for in chambers,
your point is that the court should have, or the government, well, actually the government should have advised about the results of the rapid test, even though there was going to be further testing.
Absolutely, Your Honor, because everybody, when entering the courthouse, had to answer a question. And the question said, in the past 10 days, have you tested positive for COVID-19? And a subsequent negative test wouldn't have given Ms. Hinkie a reason to say no. So she would have walked into, even if she tested negative, she would have walked into court and they would have asked her, in the past 10 days, have you tested positive for COVID? And if she said no, she would have been lying. And if she said yes, she would have been denied entry to the court, or so I presume. We don't know that because the press
can override that if he knows it's a negative test.
I believe under the COVID rules, it's the chief judge of the district who has the sole authority to interpret those rules. So my understanding is they would have had to ask.
I mean, Judge Ludington couldn't have called the chief and gotten permission to bring a
witness. So my understanding was that the chief would have had to make a ruling, but nobody asked them to because this could have all been explored before the trial if they would have simply just said something and we could have found out what the ramifications of a subsequent negative test was, but the prosecution chose to withhold that information from the court. And then when they told the court about the PCR test, they chose to continue to withhold the information of their knowledge of the rapid test. And the court walked in, began that day, and nobody knew.
Why did the PCR came back positive. So why would the rapid test matter at that point?
Because it would matter because it is relevant to show the timeline as to when the government had reason to know. I'm sorry?
Okay, I understand.
Yeah.
Your point is more timeline, not whether it's relevant for COVID.
Right, it's the timeline. It's the fact that the government intentionally and deliberately tried to withhold the information that they knew about the rapid test before the trial in the way that they framed their argument and the way that they framed everything. They artfully tried to conceal the fact that they had prior knowledge of this.
Is that really the main issue here? I mean, even if the government withheld information and even if that was deplorable, we're trying to see if the declaring of the mistrial whether there was whether that was done pursuant to what the case law refers to as manifest necessity. So isn't the main thing to be decided here is whether there was manifest necessity for the judge's decision to declare the mistrial, and if there wasn't that, then double jeopardy attaches, and your client can't be subjected to another trial. Isn't that the main issue here?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Thank you for correcting me. The main issue, the reason we're here, is to see whether or not there was manifest necessity. But when looking into whether or not there was manifest necessity, in cases involving witness unavailability, the prosecution's prior knowledge that there was a risk that the witness would not be there would indicate that there was not that the witness's unavailability did not contribute to the manifest necessity.
Okay.
So the prior knowledge gave them reason to know, and they knowingly took a chance that their most material witness had COVID, and then when their most material witness turned out to have COVID, the judge should not have even taken that into consideration when declaring the mistrial, because the prosecution knowingly took the chance.
So your argument then is the trial should have gone ahead at that juncture, regardless of whether or not that particular witness was available. Is that what you're saying?
That is exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, you're out of time, so you'll have your rebuttal time.
Thank you so much.
May it please the court, Alyssa Hart Mahan for the United States. I'd like to begin by discussing the judge's unavailability for the trial. On Monday morning, the district judge informed the parties that his wife had tested positive for COVID the previous day. And the judge stated that he had tested negative on a rapid antigen test that morning, but did not feel comfortable entering the courthouse given his recent exposure. I would also note that the COVID protocols then in place had a 10-day quarantine period for individuals who had been exposed to COVID. And this was consistent with the CDC's recommendation at that time in November of 2021 that if you are a close contact of somebody who has tested positive for COVID, then you should quarantine for 10 days. So it was not clear when the judge, could enter the courthouse. Under the protocols for visitors to the courthouse, it would have been at least.
Well, let me ask you this. Had the judge been subsequently tested, not the rapid test, but the more reliable one, and found that he continued to test negative, wouldn't that have meant that he would not have had to continue with the 10-day quarantine or not entering the courthouse type thing?
The CDC's guidance under those conditions was a 10-day quarantine period. Now, if he had subsequent negative tests, you know, presumably the chief judge of the district could have overruled the COVID
protocols
problem
then
is, in effect.
Or the baffling thing is that the judge seemed to have no interest in, taking the further test to find out if he actually continued to test negative.
Your Honor, the judge did in fact mention that he was awaiting the results of a PCR and had plans to take additional tests.
Yeah, what I mean though is he proceeded to declare the mistrial without awaiting the results of that test.
So what happened was the judge said, I can't enter the courthouse today. You know, was presiding remotely. He said, I've looked carefully at my calendar and the best date for a continuance is November 30th. Now, that would have given time for the judge to resolve any questions about his exposure. It also would have given time for Henke to be available and, you know, would allow, this was in early November, so the Thanksgiving holiday was approaching. And continuances are a matter that's confined to the sound discretion of district judges. On this record, it was not an abuse of discretion. It was a proper exercise of the court's discretion to propose a November 30th continuance. And the record reveals that the court carefully considered that possibility, polled the jurors individually. And I would dispute my opponent's assertion that the jurors' conflicts were de minimis here.
That was my characterization. So I don't know if you
with respect,
blame it on
with
him.
Respect, Judge, I would dispute that characterization. So there was one juror, there were a couple of jurors who had medical appointments scheduled for that week. There was one juror who had non-refundable tickets to Mexico for that week that he had purchased long in advance.
Well, we don't know if he had non-refundable tickets.
That's, it's in the record, Your Honor.
He wasn't asked to provide any verification, but go ahead.
Well, the judge took him at his word, and that was a factual.
They are under oath when they answer it.
Yes, and the judge made a factual finding that he was not available, and that finding is fully supported by the record here. I would also note that the defendant did not dispute that finding at the time of the hearing. The defendant didn't challenge any of the judge's findings regarding the unavailability.
Didn't the defendant also agree that the judge could not come in the courthouse and didn't ask for the judge to get a waiver or expedite the test or do anything like that?
Yes, and the defendant also did not propose a shorter continuance. The defendant did not propose any alternatives that would have allowed the...
Well,
he did not propose many of the alternatives that he now raises on
appeal. To be honest, the judge didn't indicate any openness to any other approaches or remedies in terms of... how long a continuance he would permit. He had a window there that he said would be the date that they would resume if they could, would be the continued trial date if they could, if the court did decide to arrange or grant the continuance.
The judge did state that he had carefully reviewed his calendar, and the judge's calendar is within the sound discretion of the district judge here.
Counsel, why didn't, I guess the bottom of all of this pile is that the prosecutor knew that his star witness, at least on a rapid test, tested positive, and didn't tell the judge before impaneling the jury.
The prosecutor did have knowledge of the rapid test before the jury was impaneled, and the district judge found that the prosecutor should have notified the parties, and that was a mistake. We agree that the better course would have been to disclose that information.
So why isn't this Downham then?
Because, for several reasons, Your Honor. First, this witness was material, as we represented in our filings below. She was the defendant's bookkeeper during the years in question. But she was not an essential witness. She was not, in Downham and in this court's decision in Stevens, the unavailable witness was key to the government's case. The government had insufficient evidence to prove the charged crimes without the testimony of those witnesses. And that was not the case here. We would have rather had witness Henke's testimony for the reasons explained in our filing proposing that she testify remotely by video, but we had sufficient evidence that the defendant had committed the charged crimes even without her testimony. As the government noted in its opening statement, the defendant's conduct continued across two different bookkeepers. The second bookkeeper was on the stand at the time court adjourned at the first day of trial.
And why grant the continuance? Why not just try the case if the witness isn't that essential?
Your Honor, the district court found that the technology in the courthouse was not sufficient for the court to preside remotely, and the judge was not available to enter the courthouse on the day that the mistrial was declared. So the government sort of deferred to the district court's proposed solution of a continuance. The government agreed to the continuance, said we'll be ready to go forward on November 30th, which was the date proposed by the district court. And then when five jurors were unavailable on that date, the government agreed that a mistrial was necessary. But the government proposed a number of different alternatives, and the government was prepared to go forward without her testimony.
Of course, the judge didn't ask any follow-up questions. Didn't interrogate the jurors whatsoever to try to ascertain, number one, the truthfulness of their representation, or number two, how compelling their conflicts were. The whole thing was just very, very casual. Can you be here? And they said, no, I got to go to my kid's ball game, or this or that. And no scrutiny or follow-up whatsoever by the judge. It was almost as though the judge wanted them to be unavailable. When you see that lack of follow-up and lack of questioning of the juror scheduled by the judge.
I would submit, Your Honor, that the transcript shows the district judge did individually question each juror that said they had a scheduling conflict.
Well, very little. I read the transcript. He was very receptive to their representations that they couldn't make it.
I mean, he did inquire, for instance, the juror that had travel plans. He said, and you've already purchased your tickets? And the juror said yes. And, you know, the jurors are under oath. The judge took them at their word, and that was a factual finding that is supported by the record in this case.
Well, he didn't ask them if they had purchased their ticket. He asked them if
he did, Your Honor, he did. He said, and you have made your plans.
Yeah, you had made your plans. He didn't say they had asked. And he didn't ask them if it was refundable, anything like that. There was no questions along those lines.
My recollection is he did ask follow-up questions about those plans. The court also noted that a couple of jurors had pre-scheduled medical appointments.
There's the issue of whether they could have rescheduled. I mean, none of this was adequately delved into.
So I would also note that the defendant did not raise any objections to these findings, and in our view, that means the court's ruling should be reviewed for plain error.
Well, the defendants aren't running the courtroom. Hold on. We can't both talk at the same time.
I apologize, Your Honor.
I've forgotten what I was saying. Go ahead.
The defendant has an obligation to raise objections before the district court, and if he does not, then this court will review for plain error. The defendant did not object to the court's finding that the jurors were not available on November 30th.
Of course, it's the judge's responsibility to decide on the adjournment, taking all things into account. I mean, the defendants don't run the courtroom, and they can't decide the court's, at least not unilaterally, decide the court's calendar.
Correct, but the defendant did not suggest a shorter continuance. The defendant did not challenge the court's findings about the availability of the juror.
Well, I'm sorry, I interrupted you that time, but the defendants may have wanted there to be confusion and problems developing in the calendar. If they were looking down the road to develop an argument there could be a double jeopardy problem if the case had to be retried. That's why the decision is left to the court regarding these matters.
Your Honor, the defendant has an obligation to preserve arguments before the district judge so that the district judge has an opportunity to consider those arguments in the first instance. The defendant did not propose a shorter continuance. The defendant did not propose that the judge preside remotely. The defendant did not dispute the district judge's findings about the availabilities of the jurors. And on this record, you know, this court should review accordingly. The defendant objected to everything that was proposed. He objected to remote testimony by the witness. And so that, in my view, tends to suggest that the defendant, you know, wanted to preserve this double jeopardy argument down the road.
All right.
I also wanted to note that the manifest necessity standard, as laid out by the Supreme Court and by this court's precedents, is not a rigid, bright line rule. It is a highly fact-specific standard. And if you look at the circumstances here, the district court was facing a unique set of challenges caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. The judge was not able to enter the courtroom for possibly up to 10 days, perhaps longer if he eventually tested positive for COVID-19, which was unknown at that time. The judge specifically found that the courtroom technology did not lend itself well to remotely presiding over a trial. It would not have been appropriate for a magistrate judge to preside over the trial. The court carefully considered the possibility of a continuance based on its calendar and polled the jury and found that a continuance was impossible.
Do you think the judge should have awaited, before ruling on these matters, should have awaited the result of his COVID test?
No, Your Honor, because I think when there's been an exposure or a close contact, there's sort of a gray area where you're not sure whether, you know, you might eventually develop COVID or not. That's why the CDC recommended a 10-day quarantine period at the time. So I'm not sure that it would, that the outcome here
well,
turns on.
Well, if he had gotten a negative test back, the 10-day quarantine recommendation would not have applied to him.
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. The questionnaire for entering the courtroom asked, have you been within the last 10 days, have you been exposed to anyone who
tested positive? I thought that was a local rule, too, as well. I thought it was a local rule as well as a CDC rule. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. That was the courthouse questionnaire. I think that was the district's COVID protocol was, if you have been exposed to somebody within the last 10 days who tested positive for COVID-19, then you may not enter the courthouse for 10 days if you've had any exposure within the last 10 days.
So can I flip that on you? Because your friend on the other side says, well, that's right. So when you got the government got the positive test, they knew she couldn't enter for 10 days. Because it's also, it's not have you been exposed. It's have you been exposed or have you tested positive?
Correct. And the government believed at the time that the PCR test would be the dispositive test and would govern, would overrule.
But Judge Clay is asking the flip side of that, which is if the PCR is dispositive for the witness, why isn't it for the judge?
Because for the judge, there was a question of exposure, which is different than the question of testing positive. Those are two separate inquiries. And that's why there are two separate questions on the courthouse questionnaire. And if you'd like to look at the questionnaire, it's at page ID 1202. The first question is, have you tested positive for COVID within the last 10 days? The second question, which is independent of the first question, is, have you been exposed to anyone who tested positive for COVID-19 in the last 10 days? So those are independent questions. So the manifest necessity standard is a fact-specific inquiry, and the circumstances that the district court faced here made the tribunal unavailable to continue with the trial in the near future. The court carefully considered the possibility of a continuance based on its calendar, based on a date that would work with its calendar, and when that date was impossible, the court properly declared a mistrial.
All right.
I ask you, the court to affirm. Thank you.
Out of time. Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple points I'd like to hit. My colleague pointed out several times that the court stated that they carefully considered their calendar and the only available date for a continuance was November 30th. However, I'd like to remind the court that we were still in trial and we were scheduled to be in trial for the rest of the week, and a continuance of one day was within the court's calendar because the court was scheduled to have been in trial the rest of the week, and we could have finished the trial with a one-day continuance without altering the court's schedule anyway. And a one-day continuance would have given the court time to properly explore the option of running the trial remotely, which the judge stated that the courtroom technology was ill-equipped for a remote proceeding, but he himself proceeded remotely that day. Additionally, other federal courts around the country had held virtual trials already, so it was definitely possible for the trial to continue with the judge providing remotely. Additionally, a one-day continuance would have given the judge an opportunity to see if another judge was available in the district to come in and take over the trial. And lastly,
did the defendant ask the judge to do that?
Good question, Your Honor. No, the defendant did not ask the judge to do that, and that brings me to my final point. The court did not give the defendant much opportunity to propose any alternatives. One, we were in chambers and we were raising our objections. The judge made it very clear that there was two options, a mistrial or a continuance to November 30th. In fact, he interrupted while we were making our objections and said, I've heard enough. There's only two options here, a continuance to November 30th and a mistrial. So the judge had made it abundantly clear that he was not going to entertain a shorter continuance. Additionally, this whole thing happened in the span of 15 minutes. The judge didn't even give the parties an opportunity to brief the issue and to frame our arguments and to think of them and put them in writing and submit them to the court. In a matter of 15 minutes, he came in, he had already decided that there's only two options, a mistrial or a continuance to November 30th.
Did you ask to brief it?
I did not ask to brief it because as I was objecting, he made it very clear, I heard enough. We're either going to mistrial or we're going to continue to November 30th, and then after he stated that.
Parties often say, then can I put my objections in writing, and judges always let you. I mean, if you ask, judges always let you put your objections in writing.
Well.
Right, it's one thing to hear enough in a conference. It's another thing to say, look, can I brief these issues because I think there's some critical issues. The judge is going to want to hear.
Of course, but in the case of a mistrial, it's the court's duty to make a finding of manifest necessity, and part of that is to explore other alternatives. So the court should not have waited for a party to ask to state their objections. They should have more carefully considered.
Why? If you don't state your objections, a court can assume you don't have them, and if you ask to put them in writing, you said, well, I wanted time to develop them, but I never asked to have time to develop them.
Well, I want to remind the court, I did object to the mistrial, and I did object to the continuance. Okay, and then I started to state my arguments, and he said, I've heard enough. This is it. We're either going to continue or we're going to mistrial. And no other option was considered. And when they walked in that day with those two options on his mind, and then later discovered that the prosecution knew all along that the witness had COVID, it did not seem to slow things down a bit, and the judge did not seem to question what ramifications that had on his decision. There should have been a pause to stop and say, hey, wait a minute. We just found out that the prosecution had reason to know their witness would be unavailable, and the judge should have more carefully thought about whether or not a mistrial was appropriate in those circumstances. But he made it clear that he didn't want to hear it and that he had made up his mind before he walked in, we're either going to have a mistrial or we're going to have a continuance. Which one's it going to be? And when we objected to both, He cut off the objections and said, well, let's go poll the jury and see if they can continue. And then he polled the jury, decided they couldn't continue, and after having provided two options, mistrial or continuance wasn't on the table, he went to mistrial. And there could have been a one-day continuance where a lot more deliberation, a lot more factual development can take in place. In the case of manifest necessity, I think the case law is clear. The factual basis establishing manifest necessity needs to be on the record, and in this case it is not on the record because the judge acted abruptly and hastily without calm deliberation into the matter.
You said that the judge was presiding remotely during that proceeding you were just describing. Was he over the phone or how was he remote?
So when we walked into court that day, we went back into chambers and he was over the phone, and then we went back into the courtroom to call the jury in, and he was on a TV screen where everybody could see and hear him, and he could see and hear everybody else.
Okay, thank you very much for your arguments, and the case is submitted.